It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. The 17th century was the golden age for pirates. That included some fearsome women, sometimes in disguise as men, on the high seas. The Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc launched a series of presentations spotlighting historical seafaring women. The series is called The Great Women of the Great Lakes and Beyond. This month is about female pirates. Michelle Kuhl is a professor of history at UW Oshkosh. She's set to give a presentation about female pirates and talk to Kate Archer Kent about her research.
Your history classes range from African-American history, and they touch down on women's history, to the history of pirates. What is the connection you find between the history of pirates and your other areas of research?
Well, that's a great question. This is all under the umbrella of social history. Before the mid-20th century, most history was about people with power from the top down, presidents, generals, right? You know, but with the civil rights movement, the second wave feminist movement, the Black Power movement, a number of other movements, people started wanting to hear about the history of people who maybe didn't have as much power and maybe weren't literate and didn't leave a lot of letters and diaries or documents or things like that. So I got really interested in women's history. And that also, I was also very interested in race. I grew up in North Carolina in the 70s and 80s when they were still getting around to integrating schools. And when I went to graduate school, I took a lot of social history from professors who look at history, as we say, from the bottom up instead of from the top down. We look at it from the bottom up. So pirates are part of that because pirates start off as poor sailors who mutiny. It's one way of seeing them is just as criminals, but another way of seeing them is a class revolt of poor sailors revolting against poor treatment and poor pay and hoping for a better life for themselves. So all three of these things come out of sort of mid to late 20th century movements to learn more about the world and look at all people in history.
And 1650s through the late 1720s is described as this golden age for pirates. And this is a period associated with colonization and the African slave trade and trade routes. Do you think that female piracy is like a natural extension there of your research into these underrepresented voices?
Absolutely, right? And female pirates are very unusual. There's not too many of them. So the few that there are, people are very fascinated with them because it's a very male world, the world of sailors, the world of the Navy, the world of merchant ships. For a lot of reasons that men were the ones who had these jobs. It required a lot of brute strength to be a sailor, to load cargo on and off ships and to hoist sails and to do all these things or to, you know, load cannon and fight. So it's a very male dominated world. So people get really fascinated with the women in it. So there's only a few women who are pirates, but they take an outside importance in the imagination.
And I thought historically women weren't allowed to be on these ships, especially once they set sail. Were women allowed on board?
That's a great question. For the most part, no. Many ship captains, both legitimate ship captains and pirate ship captains, didn't want women on board because they found it divisive that basically the crew would fight over them and it would cause tensions amongst the men and cut into their camaraderie and whatnot, which was very important to them for their fighting strength and their ability to work together and basically not die at sea, right? Mm. Because it's very risky to cross the Atlantic or the Pacific in these little wooden boats. Unfortunately, this is a world of a lot of violence, a lot of dominance, a lot of authority, and many of the men certainly liked visiting women, prostitutes. Some of them had wives when they were on shore, but they did not want women on the ship because it sort of broke up the male bonding, as it were, on the ship.
And it seems like this lasted for quite some time in history in seafaring professions, barring women, until like fairly recent history, like in the 20th century. What have you found there?
Well, right. There's actually some people who push back against that a bit and argue that there's actually more women than we realize on ships, that they come as seamstresses and laundresses and things like that. So it is a contested situation about, like, basically, you know, what they're saying in public and what they're doing in private. And this is also true of wars as well, that we think of, you know, 18th, 19th century wars as being almost entirely all male. But there's often quite a few women. They are sometimes called camp followers or things like that, who traveled with armies to do laundry and make food and boil water, or, you know, boil the lice out of your clothing, things like that. That would be very helpful. And there's more of that than you might think. And they're sometimes even considered so important that they're given rations and things like that. In the Seven Years' War before the American Revolution, the Puritans of New England were actually pretty horrified about fighting alongside British regiments against the French, because there were so many of these camp followers that the Puritans basically considered, you know, prostitutes. And that they were, that was a real source of tension between the New England Puritans and the British army. I think one of the historians that talks about this is Linda Grant DePaul, who argues that there's actually more women at sea than we thought. And another author is Diane Dugow, who thinks there's more of them than we might know. But it, you know, it's an ongoing conversation amongst historians.
Is there any indication that female pirates were captains of their own ships?
One of the most successful pirates ever was a Chinese woman who amassed a huge fleet, and basically the government couldn't defeat her, so they basically bribed her. So she's one of the most powerful in terms of just sheer number of people who sailed under her. There's an Irish woman who's a captain as well. But again, they're pretty unusual. In the Caribbean, there's two famous women pirates, Anne Bonny and Mary Read, and they don't become captains. They mainly just sail around with the pirates for a little bit.
I was fascinated by their story. Mary Read, an English pirate, and a crewmate, this Anne Bonny. And so what were they able to accomplish together?
Well, I think what a lot of pirates accomplished, which was to basically reject the life you're born with and create a new life. And it's a trade-off, right? And this is true for poor sailors. It's true for these women who are turning their backs on their nation. Often they're turning their backs on religion. They're turning their backs on their identities. And in the case of women, they're turning their backs on the expectations of women at the time. They're turning their backs on being ladies, right? There's no lady pirates, right? And so by being a pirate, they are embracing a risky, probably short life, but one that has more freedom, more wealth, and more adventure than their old life. It's one of the reasons the pirate flag across multiple pirate ships has some form of death on it. The death's head, a skeleton, sometimes a skeleton holding an hourglass. And those symbols are partly about trying to frighten other ships, right? That we're coming. And pirates are brave, but they're also kind of lazy. So if they could frighten ships into just like surrendering and giving over their treasure, great, right? So they do a lot of things that try to frighten other ships. But they also use that symbol as part of their ethos of saying, we would rather die in a battle at sea in a year or two than live a horrible life toiling away for little money, for little autonomy, with little control over your life. We're tossing aside that life and we're trading it for a short, violent, but exciting life that we control. And I think for these women pirates, they're definitely embracing that side of piracy.
We're talking about the history of female pirates with Michelle Kuhl, professor at UW Oshkosh, and giving a presentation at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc. It's called Great Women of the Great Lakes and Beyond. Is there any indication, Michelle, you know, here in the Great Lakes, we found many shipwrecks. Do you know of any treasures that they acquired?
Yeah, this history in this area is really rich. Anywhere you have a coastline and something of a weak state, pirates pop up. So that's true in the ancient world in the Mediterranean. That's true off the coast of Somalia right now. It's true in parts of the Amazon River. Anytime you have water and people on boats and there's a weakness, people will pop up and take advantage of that weakness and try to steal things from other people. So, right. So the Great Lakes are true, too. If there's parts of the coastline that are not well patrolled, pirates will fill that gap.
Do you know anything about the bounties that these female pirates were able to acquire? Any historical records there?
Oh, that's a great question. I would imagine that the Chinese pirate got a great deal more treasure than any other pirate in history. The female pirates, too, I have a theory of the ones in the Caribbean. They're both associated with a man named Calico Jack Rackham, who wore colorful calico prints, probably from India or somewhere else, going around and trading. And he was kind of a ladies' man. They both kind of had a relationship with him, and he dressed sort of flamboyantly. And I've always thought he is maybe the inspiration for the character in the Pirates of the Caribbean,
Oh,
the main
okay.
character. And I think they don't have, and so I think the female pirates have that association help popularize him.
When you talk about Anne Bonny, a legendary female pirate, they were also known to dress in men's clothing as a disguise. Can you tell us about that impact of dressing as male pirates?
Right. Apparently, they were pretty good at that. And I believe it's Mary Read whose mother started her down that road because her mother had a husband who went to sea and they had a son. But then the son died and the wife got pregnant by another man. And she gave birth to a girl, but she didn't want her husband or her husband's family to know that she'd had this illegitimate child by another man. So she dressed her as a boy. And apparently it worked. Her husband's family kept supporting her financially and whatnot. So she grew up having that cross-dressing experience. So she was pretty good at imitating not just how men dressed, but how they walked, right? How they interacted with people and things like that. So when she became a pirate, she ran into another woman who was also dressing as a pirate. And apparently they're both pretty brave. They fought well. And it's only when their breasts were exposed that they could be known as women and that sort of gave them away.
These stories of disguise, I think, as you mentioned earlier, are applicable to other areas of battle for women, whether it's in a war or on a pirate ship.
Absolutely, right. There's some indication that on a day-to-day basis on the pirate ship, since everyone knew who they were, by that point, they probably wore women's clothing, but they put men's clothing on for battle. Like if they were heading towards another ship and there was going to be a fight, they would put on trousers and bind up their chests and so that they could sword fight and things like that. And apparently they, by all accounts, they were very brave and they beat some men pretty badly. So
The drink being offered during your presentation is called grog. How is grog associated with pirates?
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that. That's fantastic. Well, the way people thought about alcohol in these earlier centuries is very different than the way we think about it today. We know a lot about the chemistry of alcohol and how it affects your brain and your liver and all these sorts of things, but in earlier times, particularly in England, a lot of their rivers were polluted. The Thames in London was just disgusting, right? There's horses urinating and defecating in the street. People are tossing offal and, chicken guts and pig guts, and there's just, dead bodies. So it's just the water, they didn't understand the chemistry of it. Like they hadn't yet looked at things through microscopes and discovered the world of microscopic germs and viruses and bacteria. But they knew that drinking the water could make you sick, whereas drinking something like beer or cider didn't make you sick. And we know today it's the fermentation process kills the bacteria. They didn't know that. So people, children, teenagers, adults, all drink quite a lot of beer. Benjamin Franklin went to London to work at a printer shop at one point in the 18th century, and he liked experimenting with his food and drink. He was a vegetarian for a time, experimentally, and he decided to stop drinking, and he noticed that the people around him routinely drank 6 pints a day, like a pint at breakfast, a pint at your mid-morning, a pint at lunch, a pint after lunch, a pint in the afternoon, and a pint with dinner. And he noticed that when he quit drinking and he just drank water, he was clear-headed and could carry more than the other men, which to our eyes today, we think, well, of course, you're not drunk all day. But it's very routine. And rum was an important part and other alcoholic drinks of naval ships and the merchant naval ships. And it sometimes would help the sailors have a perception of warmth. We all know that's not real, but a perception of warmth in cold climates and things like that, and sort of pacified them and they expected it. So it was almost part of their like rations or wages. If you've ever seen guys at a football game with their shirts off in freezing weather, like at a Packers game, they're drunk so they don't feel the cold. It's really not a great practice for those listening. But that's sort of what sailors did. If they were sailing around like pretty far south, like around the tip of South America or something, it's very cold and they didn't have great clothing. And They would drink a lot to try and feel warm. So
Yeah.
people
They.
were drunk quite a bit in those
Yes.
days.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your research.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Michelle Kuhl is a professor of history at UW Oshkosh. She talked to Kate Archer Kent. Her presentation is set for tonight at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc. It's part of its series called Great Women of the Great Lakes and Beyond. And for disclosure, Wisconsin Maritime Museum is a business sponsor of WPR.